For those of you who may not know me as well, you may discover that before I became a pastor, I spent a couple of years working as a therapist. My first master's degree was, in fact, in marriage and family therapy. And one of the things that we learned over and over, especially as I met with many clients and patients, and even now, as I do a lot of pastoral counseling, is that when people do not learn from the mistakes of their parents, what happens? They tend to become their parents. You know what I mean? It's like I meet young men who are super emotionally closed, and they're very angry at their dads who are super emotionally closed, but they become that exact same person. Or people who have an explosive temper, and they had a mom or dad that couldn't hold their tongue, couldn't hold their temper, and they vowed, like, I'm never going to be like this person. I hate this person. I'm never going to have a relationship with this person. And they grow up to become the exact same person. Someone who has a parent who is very controlling, and then you turn out exactly the same. If you have a parent who is very messy, it's amazing that some of the kids turn out exactly the same. We have those two extremes in my household. But it's interesting to me because we think about, you know, we think sometimes that psychology is just this mumbo-jumbo, but there's a reflection of what is true from it that we see in the Bible as well. And you've heard that very familiar saying, those who fail to remember the mistakes of the past are doomed to what? Repeat it. And for God's people, oftentimes those who've been set free, who've been once set free, have a tendency to forget over time and to crawl back into the prisons that God released them from. And so, as we think about these kind of ideas and concepts, that means that as we start this new season, as we start rolling into the new year, we need to intentionally reflect on our past so that we can continue living in the freedom that God has given us and learn to, likewise, pass that on to generations that come after us. Because those who fail to learn from the mistakes of the past are doomed to repeat it, and children who don't learn from the mistakes of their parents tend to repeat those as well and tend to become their parents. And so if you have a Bible, you want to turn in it to Exodus chapter 13. Exodus chapter 13, we're in this series called Unbound, where we are learning as we encounter the God of glory, that there's something about meeting with Him and experiencing Him that sets us free to worship Him and become His people together. And we're at a point in the story where God has delivered His people from slavery through these great judgments against the people of Egypt, culminating in the Passover, perhaps the greatest and most fearsome judgment, plague, and miracle in the Old Testament. And that by faith, God's people had to trust Him that somehow by taking the blood of an unblemished lamb and painting it on their doorposts across the top and the sides, that can somehow be a substitute payment for their own sin. And so as the Israelites have been given a new calendar, as you remember, God instructed them to celebrate this Passover meal by eating year after year a roasted Passover lamb. So their whole new calendar revolves around this Passover miracle. And they are on this threshold of a new season, a new journey into freedom that doesn't just simply mark the passage of time, this new calendar around the Passover, but it also reflects the spiritual significance that God is preparing them and preparing us to be set free, to worship Him, to become His people. So here we are in chapter 13, at the beginning of this march from slavery to promise. God gives some instructions after already talking about the Passover meal itself. Chapter 13, the Lord said to Moses, "Consecrate to me all the firstborn. Whoever is the first to open the womb amongst the people of Israel, both of men and of beasts, is mine." Then Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you came out from Egypt, out of the house of slavery, for by a strong hand the Lord brought you out from this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. Today in the month of Abib you are going out, and when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which He swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, you shall keep this service, this worship service, in this month. 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten for 7 days. No leavened bread shall be seen with you, and no leaven shall be seen with you in all your territory. You shall tell your son on that day, 'It is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt, and it shall be to you as a sign on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the law of the Lord may be in your mouth, for with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this statute at its appointed time from year to year. Let's stop right there. So God gives his people some instructions through his servant Moses. He starts off telling them to consecrate. You remember, we talked about this idea of what does consecrate mean? It means to make something holy, to set it apart for God, to God. And so that's all that means. Consecrate, make holy, set apart for God all your firstborn males of your kids and of your livestock. They all belong to me, the firstborn. Now, the question we have to ask, of course, is first of all, why these firstborn sons? Or why, whether it's animals or people? Well, in human terms, you have to remember in this ancient Near East culture that the eldest son had special responsibilities, special privileges, and special leadership of the family, including the right of inheritance. And you remember back in Exodus chapter 4, for those of you who've been with us for a while, in verses 22 and 23, that God says that Israel, the nation of Israel, they are my firstborn son. So it's kind of this whole deal with dealing with your firstborn son is a symbol to remind you about being God's, that God's people are his firstborn son. And so what's happening here is it's not favoritism that the firstborn son gets the best treatment or they're holy and they're set apart, they're consecrated to God. They're not better. But here's the point. The whole family belongs to God. And the firstborn eldest son represents the family, all his brothers and sisters. And so if you give the firstborn son to God, in essence, you're saying that I'm giving the everything, this whole family, to God. I think about like when I was a kid. Some of you know I come from a blended family, so I have two stepbrothers, one biological brother, and I used to be the eldest son. But once we had kind of these two families come together, I have an older stepbrother now, so he's the eldest. And so it's funny because, you know, the four boys, if you get four boys who are teenagers all together, it just takes about maybe 30 minutes before we end up getting in trouble over something. Something breaks, something gets lost, somebody did something, right? And so when my brothers and I got into trouble, who's the first person questioned? Who represents the rest of us? It's always the older stepbrother. It was a really good deal for me. I used to be the one that got into trouble to go talk to Rob about this, my older brother Robert. And so that's what a firstborn son does. They represent, they kind of speak for the whole family and represent the entire family. And in verse 3, Moses is telling the people, remember this most important day in history when by God's own strong hand, he delivered us out as from house, being house slaves in Egypt, out of the house of Egypt in slavery. And we remember that by keeping God's feast of unleavened bread. And this sounds like a tangent, like we're turning into a different corner, but you're going to see how it ties in just a sec. So in verse 4 and 5, Moses reminds them, mark today on your calendar. It's a holy day. It's the day when God set us free from slavery and sin. So when you arrive in the land that God promised to our forefathers, this land that's going to be wonderful, flowing with milk and honey, it's going to be this overwhelming blessing. Remember that we need to observe this worship festival. Because it's easy, right? When you are going through times of suffering, to beg God, please help, please help, please help, please save me, please do something. And then when he does that, how often we have a tendency, once we get into a good situation, to forget to give thanks or forget to appreciate, forget who set us free. And so he sets this reminder, even when you arrive in the promised land, don't forget what God has done. I want you to celebrate this worship festival every year. And in verses 6 through 7, he gives very specific instructions about how to do that, very similar to what we saw in chapter 12. So I'm not going to get into it in detail. But you remember, it's basically, you need to celebrate this feast of unleavened bread for a whole week. And that means unleavened bread, there shouldn't be any yeast in any of the bread. In fact, God says, no yeast wherever you are, wherever you live. Get rid of it, not just out of your bread, but out of your house, out of all the wherever you're settled down at the time. And you remember we talked about that eating unleavened bread, it wasn't just a symbol to the Israelites of that they were leaving in a hurry from being slaves in Egypt. Excuse me. But as you remember, the picture is that the way that yeast works is you take a little pinch from an old dough of bread, you put it into the new dough, and as the yeast kind of ferments, it starts to work its way through the entire dough, causing it to rise. That's how bread works. And because they didn't have yeast packets back in ancient Near East times, they would take friendship bread. Some of you do that today who are bakers, or you get a starter kit that already is a little bit of old bread that has yeast already in it, or old dough that has yeast in it. And that the picture there that we see throughout the Old Testament on into the New Testament is that sin works the same way. Not to bring the yeast of Egyptian influence with you, because what's going to happen, it's going to work its way through your lives and corrupt you with the leaven of idolatry, just like the Egyptians. Remember, we talked about how all these 10 plagues were God's, each of them represents God warring and having an assault against the false gods of Egypt. And so God's intent is that when you celebrate this Feast of Unleavened Bread, when you don't eat bread that has yeast in it, it's a picture of not only is God taking his people out of Egypt, but he's taking Egypt out of his people. And so when you do all this celebration feast, it's not just a reminder for yourself. God is telling his people, I want you to have this huge celebration where you're going to have a feast, you're going to party for 7 days, and there's going to be a lot of unleavened bread. And the purpose of it is to remind each other how God has set us free from slavery to sin. And I want you to see that. That's very important, because it's easy for us to get very individualistic, especially from a Western American Christian perspective, that my relationship with God is just about me. And so don't bug me about like how I should remember God or worship God or how much time I spend with God, whether I should pray or not. But what we see here is a picture of God commanding his people. I want you to celebrate this feast together, because part of what happens here is that we remind each other. We remind each other how God has set us free from slavery to sin. And so he says, we know this because in verse 8, it says, when your sons ask a question about, tell your son. This is where it ties back into the beginning. That son that you consecrated, that son that you set apart to God and for God. Tell your son that we celebrate this Feast of Unleavened Bread because of what the Lord did for us in Egypt. And this is particularly relevant for you, my son. You see, you should have died in Egypt, along with the rest of the firstborn in all the land of Egypt. But God delivered us. God rescued us from slavery to sin and death, particularly through the Passover, and particularly you, my eldest son. And so when we think about these kinds of things, you know, it's interesting because in verse 9 through 10, God tells them, you know, I want you to celebrate this always because it's a reminder to ourselves every year through this festival. And if you'll notice in the language, it says, it'll be like when you celebrate this festival, it'll be like having written on a wristband or something for your hand or on a headband between your eyes. It's like a reminder to us to thank God, to appreciate him, to worship him. And that all these things, thanks, appreciation, worship, should come out of our mouths for exerting his strong hand and delivering us out of Egypt and out of slavery. Now, what happens with the Israelite people is that they took God's analogy literally. And it's interesting because the language of the text actually is, well, when you celebrate this feast, it should be just as if you have these things written on your wrist, on your around between your eyes, so that worship comes out of your mouth towards God. And so they would literally do that. They would write it on these wristbands that they wore around their wrist. They would put it on these headbands that they would put around their heads. And they would write those reminders on it, which seems silly. But that's not very different than us. We're forgetful too. So it's just like if you wrote little reminders on a Post-it note, and you stick them all over your desk or your computer, or when you use your Google Calendar, or when you use your iPhone to remind you about important appointments and dates. But the problem is, for the Israelite people, they became more concerned about observing these man-made religious traditions than what it represents. And that sounds very silly, right? Like, so you're saying that the Israelite people, after a while, they just kind of wore like these headbands and frontlets that, with little things dangling over, with little reminders written, and they had things on their wrists and stuff like that, but they forgot to worship God. They forgot what it meant in their hearts. And this sounds silly, but don't we do that too? You heard me talk about it a little bit last week, but all of our Christmas traditions that we have, we celebrate them religiously. You need to have a Christmas tree. And there should be a star on top of it. And there needs to be gifts underneath the tree. And, you know, we celebrate Christmas and there needs to be things like candy canes. And you remember last time I talked about how a lot of times we don't remember what they signify, what they represent. That the tree is a symbol of a man named Jesus who was hung on a tree on our behalf. That the star is a symbol that reminds us of a star that hung over Bethlehem that led wise men and people to come and worship the coming of a Messiah king, that the gifts under a tree are a reminder that God gave His greatest gift, His own Son, to give us eternal life as a free gift, and that a candy cane, in fact, that the white of the candy, it represents and shows us the purity of our God, and that the red stripe that goes, that drips down from it, is a reminder of His blood shed on our behalf. It's so easy to remember the traditions without remembering what it represents in our hearts. And so, as far as this section is concerned, I want you to be thinking about what is God trying to remind us today? Do you consecrate others? Do you teach your sons and daughters? Do you help generations that come after you to be set apart, to be made holy through what God has done? And I want to tell you, you know, it's easy for us to kind of tune out right now, especially if many of us are not parents. But think of it this way. There are people that are younger than you, sitting right here next to you. It may be younger physically in age, or just younger spiritually in their understanding of Christ, in their relationship with God. There's people that you come in contact with and that you have influence with every day in your home, at your school, in your workplace. Do you help them to know what it means to be set apart for God? Do you show them? And I want you to know that, note this in this passage. The focus isn't just on what you say to your sons and daughters. Right? It only takes one verse. Verse 8, tell your son this. But actually, the focus isn't simply on just what you say, but how you live it out through the practice of this feast of remembrance, through the testimony of your life, through the testimony of your praise that should be coming out of your mouth. And so you want to ask yourself, am I simply saying certain words, or am I living it out as an example for people around me? How do I need to live out this feast of unleavened bread? We obviously do not keep it the same way. And you remember I talked about it during Christmas, that we don't celebrate the same way anymore because we're in a new relationship with God. But there's something important that we can see from that. That do we live in such a way that shows how God has set you and me apart, set us free from slavery to sin and to death? You see, I always ask myself this question, have I gotten rid of that yeast of idolatry and sin in my life? Because the reality is, you know what? We take this kind of list. We form a list when we think of coming before God, and there's a list of all these sins that maybe are in our lives, and we like to check off the boxes that, well, here's these sins. I'm willing to get rid of maybe 9 out of 10 of the sins and on my list. But there's, and so that's, I've done pretty well, but you know what? I just want to keep a pinch of this yeast, just a pinch of materialism and greed, just a pinch of my selfishness and lust, just a pinch of my anger or my pride. So I check all the boxes that I don't mind God removing, but I like to keep a few of these for myself. And we don't realize that what it does is when we keep that little pinch of yeast, that it has a tendency to work its way through the entire dough of our lives and corrupting and influencing the whole thing. Do you get rid of that yeast of idolatry and sin? And like the Israelites, that we understand that it's not just about ourselves, but we celebrate how God has set us free from slavery to sin as part of a community. And so we want to ask ourselves, do we have people in our lives that remind each other how God has set us free? Do we have friends or small group that remind us on a regular basis that we live life unleavened by sin and idolatry? Or are you like me, sometimes have a tendency to go it alone, not get plugged in with friends at church who can spiritually encourage you or whom you can encourage? You see, a lot of times we think about it in terms of, well, I don't want to deal with people, and you know, people get on my nerves, they're a lot of trouble, they're a lot of work. And we forget that when you're part of the community and you fail to participate in it, that you are robbing other people of the blessing that God wants to give them through you as well. Does giving thanks and appreciation and worship to God come naturally from our lips and from our heart as we remind each other about what God has done to set us free? Or does it become meaningless religious ritual? How might that need to change? And how do you need to ask Jesus to help you change that this morning? So here we are, and God has given the Israelites various instructions. He gave them this Passover lamb meal, as well as this week-long feast of unleavened bread. And then he gives one last piece of further instruction that I want to look at this morning. Let's pick up where we left off in verse 11. When the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers and shall give it to you, you shall set apart to the Lord all that first opens the womb, all the firstborn of the animals that are males shall be the Lord's. That should sound familiar to you. Every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. Or, if you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. Every firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. And when in time to come, your son asks you, what does this mean? You shall say to him, by a strong hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. For when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of men and the firstborn of animals. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord all the males that first opened the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be as a mark on your hand or frontlets between your eyes, for by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. So here we go. What in the world is happening here? In verse 11 and 12, just like it reminds us in verse 5, when, not if, the Lord brings us to this land promised to your forefathers, set apart to you, to God and for God, all the firstborn male livestock. Okay, so this, now he's talking about strictly the livestock. They belong to God. And that should sound very familiar, just like verse 5. And when he says that they're set apart for God, what he really means is it's kind of a euphemism for saying that these firstborn animals are going to be sacrificed as a burnt offering to God. Not because God is hungry for prime rib. My wife cooked this wonderful Christmas prime rib for our family this past Christmas night. But that is not what God's problem is. It's not like, you know what, I want you to sacrifice all the firstborn animals of your livestock so I can take food out of the mouths of your children because I'm so hungry. But what's happening here is it's a reminder to his people that just as the firstborn son represents the whole family, that the whole family belongs to God, the firstborn of your livestock also represents that all the animals that we have, it all belongs to God. And so those firstborn animals are set apart as first fruits to God because they're already his anyway. It's just a reminder to us that everything is his. But what's weird about this passage, there's this weird exception, right, that happens in verse 13. Beginning of verse 13, he says, every firstborn donkey, don't sacrifice that as an offering. Instead, you need to redeem it by sacrificing another unblemished lamb, or else you need to break its neck. That's weird. Why? You see, if you read through the Old Testament, you're going to see later on as God reveals more of his law to his people, that God kind of identified that they're like clean animals and unclean animals. And they're kind of a visible reminder to the people about sinfulness, unclean, and holiness, clean animals. And so the rest of the livestock, like the cattle, the sheep, and the goats, Numbers chapter 18, verse 17 teaches us, God will say later, that these animals you set apart as holy. They're set apart for God. So you sacrifice them to God and you use them for holy things. But they are, all these animals are set apart as holy. And they're considered clean. So the Israelites, they're allowed to eat like cattle, sheep, and goats. And they're allowed to give them to God as a sacrifice, as an offering in worship to God. Because they're holy and they're clean. But donkeys are ceremonially unclean. You see, they're not to be eaten. In fact, the Israelites would only use them as pack animals. And so they're unacceptable for holy sacrifice. So when the firstborn of a donkey comes along, what you're supposed to do with it is to break its neck. Now, that sounds really harsh. Why would you do that? Because it's a symbol of the reality that if you are unclean, if you are unholy, the natural consequence is that you must die. You must pay the price with your own life when you stand before a completely holy and clean God. And so for the people, when they are enslaved, one of the things that God teaches them, when you're enslaved to, maybe whether physically the people or you're enslaved to sin, you're a slave. So you can't afford to pay the price for your freedom. That's why you're a slave. But you can be redeemed by another. You can have someone set you free from captivity and death by someone else paying the ransom price. That's what the word redeem means. And so the key here is in the second half of verse 13, he says that not only are you going to do this with donkeys, but every firstborn human, Israelite, male son also must be redeemed in the same way as a donkey. Why? Verse 14, when your son asks, Dad, have you lost your marbles? What in the sand hill are you doing with this whole donkey thing? Your response is to be, it's by God's own strong hand that he delivered us out of the house of slavery in Egypt, but not because we deserved it. Because in verse 15, he continues, just as Pharaoh refused to quit enslaving and slaughtering God's firstborn children. We talked about that represents Israel in chapter 4. And because of that, God visited this last and most fearsome of plagues. You remember that we talked about all those 10 plagues. They got consecutively worse and more deadly and more fearsome because God was trying to give the Egyptians a warning. Stop enslaving my firstborn son, Israel. Stop slaughtering them. And until it culminated in that final plague and judgment, that all the firstborn in Egypt, of the children and the livestock, were slain by God. And what we learned was, you know, there were times in all the plagues that God set apart the Israelites. Okay, here's a pestilence of flies, but in all the Israelite slave quarters, it was a no-fly zone, et cetera, et cetera. But in chapter 12, we saw that with this final plague, it turns out we Israelites, we God's people, we're not exempt from this final plague. We're under the same judgment. But we could be redeemed if an unblemished, holy, set-apart lamb was sacrificed as a substitute payment. And when they painted the blood on the tops of the doors and the sides of the doors. And the whole point of this section of the passage is a reminder that to each other, remind each other how God has paid the ransom price of death on our behalf. It's a physical symbol with this donkey and with all these animals that reveals some important spiritual truth. First of all, that firstborn sons and the whole family that they represent, that means all of us, like donkeys, are unclean and unholy. We deserve the death penalty. And that the donkey's broken neck, well, son, that's what would have and should have happened to you as well while we were in Egypt. Secondly, the lesson we learn is that freedom is not actually free. What I mean by that is, you know, someone else had to pay a price for your freedom, and they did. And if you belong to God, he provides this redemption sacrifice on your behalf, my son. That's why we sacrifice all these firstborn animals who are set apart as holy. But the firstborn of God's sons, representing all of us as unclean family members, just like those donkeys, God has to redeem. And so in verse 16, by keeping this redemption ceremony, it serves to teach sons and families and each other that just as if we wrote these reminders on our wristbands and our headbands or on our post-its or on our Google calendars or on our iPhones, that by the strong hand of God, he delivered us out of slavery by paying the ultimate price for our uncleanness, for our unholiness. As Melissa mentioned earlier, we're really proud of you as a church. Last Sunday, you know, you guys did such a great job of preparing practically 80 stockings to give out to families in our local city, and over 100 plates of cookies, and many of you went out into the streets to deliver cookies and sing Christmas carols and pray for people. You prayed over people's needs, things like people's health and sickness. You prayed over family problems. You prayed over job issues. You prayed over people suffering from addiction. And so we're very thankful for what God has done through you. But whenever we do an outreach like that to the community, one of the things we try to remind people who are recipients of that blessing is that, first of all, they don't have to earn it. And so we always tell people, we don't take any donations. Like, people often say, like, okay, you're from a church. Are you, like, trying to raise money or something? No. We don't take any donations. So you don't have to earn it. But secondly, we also need to remind people that it's not that you deserve it. That is something that you simply deserve to get. It's not because you're such a great person. You see, there are others who paid the price. With their time, with their effort, with their resources. Why? Why do I ask people to do that when we talk to recipients of God's blessing? It's not because our church needs credit, but we want people to know that it's not just a gift that fell out of the sky. We want to help people see that when they receive a gift, to see it as costly. It cost someone something. It came at a price from someone. That it's a valuable gift, not just, you know, something that you take and toss in the trash. People invested their time, their energy, and their resources into it. And so likewise, why we celebrate God's redemption through Jesus, like the Israelites, we need to remember and remind each other that Jesus, the firstborn over all of creation, Colossians 1:15 tells us, the firstborn from the dead, that means he rose from the dead first, ahead of us, Revelation 1:5 tells us, that this Jesus, who is the ultimate firstborn, was a sacrifice that God provided to redeem us. And that this freedom, this gift that we received, it was free, but it was not cheap. It was costly. It cost God everything, this redemption gift. And 1 Corinthians 6:20 and 1 Corinthians 7:23, God reminds us that we too, just like the donkeys, just like the Israelites in this festival or in this ritual, that we too were bought with a price. It was a costly sacrifice of shed blood of the ultimate perfect Passover lamb provided by God, his own firstborn son, Jesus. And so I want you to think about, how do you remind each other? How do you remind each other? How do you remind me? How do you remind the person sitting next to you that we were unclean, that we were unholy before God, but that we were redeemed, that God, a holy God, paid a costly price to provide a sacrifice of an unblemished lamb, his own son. Let's wrap up with this thought. God is giving the Israelites all these ceremonies and festivals, and it could just seem like tedious religious stuff. But like I talked about last Sunday, God is always telling us to remember what he has done. And I want you to think about how are you taking what you remember and passing it on to generations to come? Some of you know that Melissa and I, we have some of our closest friends living in the same house with us, and they have a daughter as well who's a few months older than our son, Indy. And it's a great blessing because we're learning how to love each other and serve each other as a community of believers in one home, and how to share resources, as well as learning how to love and reach out to the community at large, even though we struggle with that sometimes. But one of the things that I've been learning is how easy it is to pass on the wrong thing to generations to come. I remember one time, one of the things I used to like to do is I'll take Indy, and when I'm carrying him, he likes to, if you heard him probably during the Sunday or beginning of the worship service, he's yelling and screaming. He loves to yell and scream. I don't know why. He just gets very excited about nothing. You can be holding up a flower to him, and it's like, the greatest gift ever. And he wants to scream at you at the top of his lungs to let you know. And so a lot of times to calm him down, what I'll do is I'll be holding him in my hands, and I like to pat him on the bottom just to get him to calm down. Shh, pat, 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 pat. And I pat him pretty hard. It's not spanking, okay? He's not being punished. But I pat him because, and also, I'll just be honest. He's got a really fluffy butt. It is a great joy to me. It's a lot of fun to pat that fluffy butt. And there was one day when I was doing that with Indy, and Ellie was watching very carefully. And she came up, and she started doing that too. And you know, she's a little kid. She's only 1 year old, so she doesn't know how to moderate her force. So whack, 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 whack on Indy's butt. And you know, fortunately, Ellie's mom, Valine, was there to correct her, like, no, we don't do that kind of thing. We don't hit DD, because she has to call him her little brother. But, you know, I think about that moment a lot. And here's why. Whether or not you want to, consciously or not, you are teaching and influencing the next generation. You are teaching and influencing people around you about what you believe about God, about what he's done for us, about how to relate with him. You're always teaching and influencing people around you, whether you choose to do it or not. Through your words, through your choices, through your lifestyle, people see whether or not you remember Jesus, his love, his work in your life. And people see it more than by just what you say, but by how you live it out, by what you do, what you choose. So the question I want to leave you with is, what kind of influence do you have on your brothers and sisters in Christ? What is your impact on the generations to come? Let's pray.